Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
General quarters. General quarters.
General
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good afternoon, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One. And we're glad you could take some time this pre-election Sunday to join us for another live edition of Midrats. A little thing different today. Hey, it's a free-for-all. If you look there on the show, it's the phone number in the upper right-hand corner. If you'd like to turn the tables on Eagle One and myself, and you're not on our naughty list, and we'll actually take your phone call, please give us a call. Throw a question our way. We're not going to limit it to anything. Whatever suits your fancy, either on a previous topic we've covered or perhaps a subject that we haven't covered this year that you'd like to see what our thoughts are on it. Also, if you could, scroll down to the bottom of the show page if you have a little bit of stage fright with the phone. The chat room is there with the usual suspects. Eagle One is up there right now monitoring it, and I'll be there in a little bit. And if you have any questions, comments, points of order, you just want to throw your question in there, go ahead and put it up in the chat room, and we'll fold it in, one of the two of us, as the show goes along. If you're new to Midrats and you wanted to catch some of our previous shows where we actually have guests, and it's not just Eagle One and I chatting away, you can get the archives over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can take the easy route and just subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes. Well, enough of the marketing stuff. Let's go ahead and get into the show. I had a little moment of victory here earlier, later on in the week, a few days ago. My election for me is over. I'm just waiting for the rest of the country to catch up on me. I voted. It was a beautiful day to vote. It was a happy crowd voting. I don't think if the lines are anything like they usually are, I'm glad that I voted when I did, because it's going to be a bear on Tuesday. But that's good. That's why we have a republic. So republic's worth a 30-minute wait. At least that's what it was for me on Saturday to vote. And we'll see what happens on today. Just make sure you're voting. Because like my dad always says, if you don't vote, shut up. I'm not interested in your thoughts. So, yeah, you can tell how I was raised. And Eagle One, good afternoon.
Hey, Sal, how are you doing?
Not quite caffeinated as much as I should be, but I'm hanging in there. Okay. You know, this just kind of kicked things off while we kind of are within a 48 hours or so of watching the returns. From a national security point of view, at least for me, this has been a weird election in that you have one party, the party in power, and the party that's not in power. There are a couple of snide barbs here and there, but they're really not that far apart. There's been very little discussion of, even during the national security debate, it seemed that they realized that the country's bored with national security, so they went into domestic issues. And I think it was the Republican National Committee was the one that never mentioned the war we were at. And then the Democrat National Committee, you know, looked like it was a star-spangled banner extravaganza, even though they had the Russian Navy and the Turkish Air Force in the background. But, you know, you're always good with your staff, I guess. It's very peculiar from my point of view. You've been around a few more election cycles than I have, Eagle One. Have you seen an election that you remember where the national security issues were as much in the background as they are right now?
Not really. I think, with the Benghazi mess, people are making an effort to get at least that portion of our national security into the news. The overall strategy and the policies there, too. I mean, we've had Mr. Romney suggests he wants more ships and a faster building schedule. And Mr. Obama pointing out that that, you know, trying to make a reference to that he didn't really, that Mr. Romney didn't really understand the situation. And there's been a lot of discussion about that back and forth, but I think that's mostly been at a level of people familiar with the military. I haven't really heard the national media jump on that other than to, you know, they thought that was a big zinger at one of the debates. And so they made a big deal of that. But no, it seems to me that, you know, we haven't got the missile gap. We haven't got the threat of dominating world communism or any other stuff that I remember from my younger days. And there have been no pictures of, going back to the days when Goldwater was running, there have been no ads of little girls being blown up by a nuclear weapon while they're picking daisies. So, yeah, I guess it's more in the background than in the past, but it's still out there. It's still lingering, and we do need to look at that. What do you see?
I almost got the impression, it's a post I've been doing this year. One thing I've noticed, our buddy Mary from the Naval Institute put something on Facebook a few months ago, a little stick figure with his middle finger, stick it up and go, one comment and three likes. What is your people's problem? This stuff was brilliant. I put together what I thought was a pretty brilliant post on Afghanistan on the Long War. And I got more interest from what I consider a throwaway post of, you know, monkeys throwing poo against the wall than what is really critical, the war we're actually in. And I just kind of think that the candidates have caught a strange place where neither side of the political spectrum really, frankly, is energized about it. You've got the war we're in that, it is what it is, and it's trending in a direction where it's going away. And on the other side, they realize it's a political loser. So they're just not addressing it much. It's strange in that, at least from the Romney camp, there's, and we had a little discussion of this with our guest a few weeks ago, Mike Barrett, that there's almost an internal discussion going on in the Romney camp, the neocon echo, and also the neorealists, you know, who's going to get footing. And the neocon advisors and some of the Bush holders, I think, came in pretty strong earlier this year. But as they've realized what a loser politically that is, that's been attenuated a little bit. And I think the neorealists got their foot in the door, and that's why by the time the Republican National Committee came along, you wouldn't have thought that we're in a decade-long war, or we have really no kidding national security threats out there that need to be looked at. I think they're looking for a new angle. That's where you saw John Lincoln come in from the shadows and a few of those other people, and we can... We could talk about the fiscal reality or do what they want to do later. And then you also hit on something that I think was just kind of an accident, the whole Benghazi blow up that we're not going to know until Christmas at the earliest what really went on there. I am disappointed in the fact that there hasn't been much interest in the larger media. I think when a U.S. ambassador gets killed, it's not a right-wing issue. It's not a left-wing issue. It's really not a party issue. It's a lot more serious than that. And what remnants of the traditional media, if they really want to salvage what they tell themselves they are, I think CBS has tried to do some of this, but the other ones are kind of missing in action. I really think they need to rise to the occasion a little bit better to do something radical. And let's find out what really went on. I don't buy the this is hyper-classified. You can get the big pixels without getting into sources and methods and things like that. But it's an election year. It is what it is. The truth will come out. It'll just be interesting to see what it is. I don't think anybody's going to come out looking good in the end. And when you boil it down, there are four Americans dead.
One of the questions on our chat room has to do with the military response to Hurricane Sandy. Before you start off on your answer to that, let me point out to everybody that this is a free-for-all. Sal and I are expressing our own opinions. They're not opinions that should be attributed to any member of our family or anybody else that we work with or whatever. You know, let me give you the Claude Barrabee disclaimer. This shouldn't reflect on anybody but us. And, you know, you're entitled to your own opinion. If you have one, either give us a call or write it down and let us know about it, and we'll manage to try and put it on the air. Okay, so what about the Navy and military response to Sandy, and especially in light of our NORTHCOM conversation of a few shows ago?
Right. I think I know that the Navy put some ships up there. I think because since the end of the Cold War, the demilitarization of the northeast part of the country that was hit the hardest, that there were a lot of assets on the East Coast, from Norfolk and south, that they could come to their assistance. I think it's kind of the same thing that we saw during the Haiti operations. There are certain types of ships that have an inherent flexibility due to their size, their carrying capacity, and the fact that there's lifting thousands of pounds of munitions or thousands of pounds of generators, you need to lift and transport things. I think it's just another opportunity, at least to let people know that the military that they have can do more than just things overseas. I know it's traditionally seen as the National Guard, but when you have a situation such as we have here, I think a lot of the capabilities, which are inherent in the Navy more than most, to be able to provide assistance if the need is there. I've been off the grid for about 36 hours, so I don't know if there's been some good write-ups. There's been a little things, you know, four ships here, we're standing by there, and some nice talk. But has over the weekend, have you seen any articles come out which really outline some specifics, taking tonnage across the beach, kind of like what we saw in Haiti?
No, I think that... And Lee has sort of asked this question in our chat room: why does the Navy have to wait for NORTHCOM? And NORTHCOM, we went through this on that show. It's a very structured approach to responding to natural disasters. The military involvement is limited, as we keep learning, by the demands that are placed on it by our civilian managers, the politicians and other elected officials, and their delegates through the through FEMA and other places, and what we see in this case is that the Navy hasn't really been called on. I mean, we sent three ships up there, fairly nice amphib ships, and the situation is vastly different than Haiti. It's not a, other than if you're on the direct beach, it's not a place where there isn't an infrastructure, where everything is completely gone. They're bringing electricity in. There was an active National Guard. I think we had pictures of a National Guard helicopter unit available to deliver any goods that needed to be delivered by a helicopter. So a lot of the effort that we might have seen during Katrina or during the Haiti earthquake, we're not seeing it here because there's already there was a police force, there was a fire department, and maybe they're a little slow getting to where they're supposed to go. But you know, the aid is getting out there. Probably the only thing that might have been done differently was to drop more water and MREs in some of the remote areas that seem to have been struck pretty hard, the Rockaway area or the some stuff on Staten Island. But, you know, the other side of that coin is that the people who lived there, it was a mandatory evacuation. And what we continue to see, I'm taking a course in disaster management, and what we continue to see in these mandatory evacuations is that is a toothless, the mandatory is absolutely toothless. We don't grab people out of their houses and arrest them if they don't leave. But when they do stay, you know, they're always surprised, as we learn later on in the news reports, they're always surprised by the severity of the storm and that they didn't think it would really happen to them. You know, and if you'd lived in New York and, or on Staten Island or in the Long Island area and you hadn't been hit by a storm in 100 years, or, of course, they got hit by Irene last year, you know, or you survived Irene without much damage, then you might tend to go just blow this one off. This is just another problem, but we keep telling people 3 days worth of food and water. You know, leave when you're told to leave. Go find a safe place. But if you're going to stay, make sure you have 3 days food and water. You know, on day two, some local politician, congressman, is from Staten Island, is out there whining because some of his constituents don't have enough food and water. Well, and he's complaining about the Red Cross. The Red Cross is made up, the vast majority of it, 95% or more, is made up of volunteers, and they're not volunteers. May not be volunteers locally. You have to bring people in from North Carolina or Florida or Nebraska or someplace to help out with these things. And there's a logistics issue. So when they're telling you 3 days food and water, it's not because, gee, that would be a nice thing to have. It's because literally they can't get bodies there to help you out fast enough to be inside that three-day window. So 3 days is a good rule of thumb, and some of these people need to get have their act together before this stuff happens. And, you know, we also know that New Yorkers, in my experience, tend to be a little more vociferous about the quantity and quality of the aid they receive. Your view?
Yeah, being a nice little coastal southerner myself, I mean, I grew up with these things. And you're exactly right. You got to be prepared. But after every storm, you're going to have the optimists and the idiots you're going to have to deal with. And it's not the optimists that really worry you so much. It's the idiots. And a lot of people don't realize that, well, you know, somebody will be here to help me, the volunteers. Well, you know, a lot of the volunteers, they had to evacuate too. And you know, we all have stories. And I have one of my sister. She evacuated from one storm. We stayed put because I'm actually on pretty high and dry territory, relatively speaking. She rode out the storm in I-10. So some people wait too late to evacuate. And going back to what started this part of the conversation with Lee, I think it's actually a good thing that, well, first of all, you know, NORTHCOM, they know their business. They know what's available and what's needed. And there is, like you said, a lot of good lift capability in the Air National Guard especially. But I think it's a very good thing that our active duty military doesn't immediately try to jump up to the front. That's not a good precedent. That's not their job. We have disasters on a regular basis. So you know, here's our capability. We have it. If you need it, give us a call, I think is good. And if they don't need it because sometimes you can have negative help, or if it's just too hard, then that's just the way it goes. But I think the dearth of news is actually in many ways a good thing, because if it bleeds, it leads, and if it doesn't bleed, it's not getting written about. And again, we'll probably see more over the next week, but I think the response has gone as it should be.
Yeah, I don't want to keep pounding on this, but you know, I have tremendous empathy for the people who were hit by the storm and the situation they find themselves in, with where they are now, and it is really difficult not to want to rush things to them, but it's also a question of, you know, the responsibility under the National Disaster Plan is that it's local, and you're driven by what the local people want you to do if you're a national force, and, you know, what the governors, what the mayors, what the local authorities are saying they can handle. And it is a real issue when our national media will find, as somebody, I guess Mary says in the chat room, you know, the press only show, or they show the idiots. Well, it's not just the idiots. I mean, as she points out, it's a densely populated part of the country. They haven't had the experience the Gulf Coast people have had. But even so, you know, somebody must have been watching television during Katrina and these other events. You might take a, you know, it can't adopt when an emergency is coming up, you can't adopt the "it won't happen to me" philosophy. And that's, it's sad that some people have done that. The aid is being rushed to them as fast as we can get it. Now, it may not be fast enough for some other people, but it is predominantly a local issue. And the way it works is, as the local people find they can't handle something, they start calling on the follow-on echelon of people. It's the way the disaster management system works. And we're going to see some more of it. As I talk to the Red Cross weather guy down here, he's saying that they're expecting some more rain and some fairly severe weather to pop up in the New England area and New York area in the next 3 or 4 days. So we're going to see more of it. And we're going to see more problems. The situation is where we don't do things perfectly on the Gulf Coast or here in North Carolina, I'm sure even in where you live. At some point, you've either destroyed. I mean, I keep wondering about building on barrier islands. You know, we do that down here. Staten, all those islands up there are basically barrier islands, and they're going to occasionally get smacked by some of these storm surge and other hurricanes. Doesn't happen very often, but when it does, especially as tightly packed as some of those neighborhoods, where you know some serious numbers of people who are disaffected.
Yeah, and I think one thing I always encourage, I know your son has done a lot of this. You know, you got a nice bluebird day and you fly up and down the coast, especially along the barrier islands. Now look out your window at the geography. It's a lot of the barrier islands are a few thousands, millions of years of sand dunes. After sand dunes, you'll have 24 sand dune ridges, and then you have a beach. It's not permanent. Mother Nature has her way of moving things, and I don't know how much this has to do with people, but acting surprised that you live on the coast and get hit by a hurricane, but we are in a hurricane drought historically and have been for a while. We go back to what people saw prior to World War II, which is a real heavy season. This is not, regardless of what some people may say, this is not bad hurricane time at all. We've actually been very blessed for the last couple of decades. We've had a few major storms, but nothing like has been seen historically. Now, those trends, they always come back. So we've been in a drought for a while. Logic dictates that it's going to come back. We're going to see more major storms. And it could have hit worse, and it will be hit worse. But it goes back to some of the things we talked about with the NORTHCOM episode. It's knowing what's up there, knowing that you're going to need it in your assets, and how you're going to be able to utilize it in the future. Now, as far as the Navy side of the house and what we can do, you look at the Norfolk area. I was up in Norfolk when Isabel hit, and it was an okay storm. The eye went right over the city. Mayport is actually in a pretty safe spot. Northeast Florida hasn't been hit by a hurricane in decades. So if it's something that's a known, we know it's going to happen. And I forget which decade it was Connecticut got hit by a storm that's just about this big. So it may be one of those in living memory things that it just hasn't happened in living memory. But hopefully our institutions will have enough of a learning attitude and a long-term view of things that they'll keep refining, especially after Andrew and Katrina. I think we got a pretty tight system as much as you can to try to plan for these future events.
Yeah, I guess the military, there's a lot of frustration. The military just doesn't seize these things by the throat and take them, because it tends to be the large number of bodies, well-organized, disciplined people, can move a lot of stuff in a hurry. But the structure is design, because the military has other obligations, and it's nice that we can send three ships up to that area. I note that they, last I heard, they had not deployed any helicopter squadrons to on the ships. Now they may be follow-on units. I haven't checked on that, but it is not. We want to encourage the use of the National Guard. That's the governor's armed force unless it's or assistance force unless it's been national federalized, and that's, you know, that really is the way it's supposed to work. A lot of the National Guard people have excellent training in this area, and it is it's their mission set, and it's not the mission set of the Navy amphibious fleet, except on a very kind of back burner way to go in and do this stuff. Now, I assume, just like it happened in South Alabama and South Mississippi after Katrina, you know, they're with the CBs and all that, people putting landing craft ashore, there was no other way to get to some of those areas. And that does not seem to be the case. We didn't lose any bridges. We didn't lose any of the ferry boats. And it's one of those situations where, we can't always say military ought to be doing this and all that. It's not their job. And, you know, the civilian people seem to be. Somebody just disconnected me. Am I connected? No. All right. Well, Sal apparently is going to be back in a second, if you can still hear me. When he starts messing with his switchboard, that fancy, amazing things happen. But let's talk about some other stuff. Let's talk about I was going to ask Sal what kind of books he's been reading, but good military books. We've been given quite a selection, or allowed access to quite a selection from the Naval Institute Press. We've had a couple of authors on recently, Claude Barraby with his new book. And we've had Mr. Stevens on last show with the with his book about the Naval Academy, another novel. And I think it's good that we get those. We've got some other shows coming up that you'll enjoy that are based on those books. We also have, and I think in a couple of weeks, we're going to have Captain Wayne Hughes on the show to discuss the size of the fleet and some other aspects of military Navy tactics. We had, that's right. Thank you, Mary. We had author Pirate Alley, Rear Admiral Terry. Good. There goes my memory. This is what happens when you get a little older. Your memory for last name just completely disappears. But Pirate Alley is a pretty good book, and we've got a couple other good ones coming out. I'm sure Mary's going to help me here. Terry McKnight. Thank you, Mary. And we're going to have, as I say, Wayne Hughes and on and talking about the new Navy fighting machine and some other developments along Steve Phillips, right, the recipient son. Thank you, Claude. See, this is what happens. I can't remember anything, but everybody else can remember. So that's good. Let's see. Sal is texting me on another thing, saying he's having trouble reconnecting. So no surprise there. Talking about Benghazi and Benghazi Gate. I don't know if it's going to turn into Benghazi Gate. We've had so many different stories and versions of what has happened and who's responsible for what, when, that I think Sal is right that, you know, despite the fact that it looks like it's being kind of back burnered prior to the election, it may just be that it's such a complicated mess that we won't be able to find out for a few months. And there certainly is a lot of political stance taking right now that we kind of need to discount about just how bad the situation is. It doesn't look good, I'll say that. And I think the optics on it are really bad. But, I thought that about a number of things that I thought were one way, and then 6 months later I found out that I was completely wrong. Sal says he's back. Let's talk about, somebody suggested talking about West African piracy news. As you all know, there's a lot of piracy going on in West Africa now, which is out of Nigeria and along the Gulf of Guinea. Some of that is what has happened down there has been the boarding of ships, kidnapping some crew members. This is an old story from that area, and holding them for ransom. There's also been a lot about stealing. They're able to steal oil and put it into other tankers and take it off on their own. So an interesting area, interesting time. And the question is whether it'll be the next hotspot. We're certainly putting some assets and resources to developing the countries that are there. The difference between, in my view, the difference between the West Africa piracy and what's happening is in off Somalia, or happened off Somalia, was that there are no failed states. There may not be really strong states, but there aren't any failed states right now off the coast of West Africa, or on the coast of West Africa. And that is, you know, that's a huge difference. The pirates of West Africa are limited in what they can do with the vessels that they take. They did manage to take one to sea and keep it out for a while and sort of disappeared it, but it came back. They found those people, and we've gotten a lot of assets out there to help people out. But anybody has some more insight than I do, I'd be happy to see what you got. Sal, you there?
Back. Thank Good. You very much for your patience.
I think I wore my taps off my shoes.
Improvise, adapt, and overcome. Though the whole West Africa piracy thing, it'd be interesting if somebody is working the piracy issue from the Malacca Straits, where all this really started. If you remember that time I hooked you up with the late, great commissar over at Politburo Diktat, who wondered, where's the U.S. Navy? I was like, I know, right? Knew who you need to talk to back in, what was that, 07, 06 time frame. And went to Somalia. But with that, West Africa is just ungoverned states. I don't know, since decolonization in the early 60s, one man, one vote, one time, so much aid has been poured into there, and you have not, a lot of these states are extremely rich from natural resources. It just doesn't find its way to the people. And I don't know how much doing the same thing, expecting a different result, will get us there. If it's an ungoverned state, it's an ungoverned state. Probably the best way to focus is look which navies and police organizations are the least corrupt in that area. I think partnering with the South Africans is probably a good call as well. They have much better connections up the coast than we do. And just to keep an eye on it from a nuisance point of view, it's Somalia. I don't know if that's really is treading water. I think there's been some success recently in Somalia. Again, it's a wait and see, and where are the ungoverned areas? Where is that going to prop up again? I don't think you're going to see any significant changes in sub-Saharan Africa for a long time.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was trying to read my some of the posts here in the chat room, and I got behind here. I saw one from our friend Daniel Sekulich, and I'm trying to find it. Where'd it go?
Sec, post again. Well, tell you, let me jump on a grenade here.
Okay, go ahead. Go right ahead.
part of the question is, Mary asked, is it a question of the type of cargo the ships are using? And, does that lead to violence? There's an author out there who actually wrote about this, and there's actually been some discussions in there that some of these pirate organizations actually have a pretty good handle on what ships might or might not be valuable. I think on balance, though, this is all kind of a grabastic operation where they get who they can get. Perhaps they do get some indications up there on who they can take and why. But if memory serves me right, they're really making the real money is to be made off of ransom, not so much. We even saw back in the 90s and earlier, and it's still there in the Caribbean, the pirates, they're going after something different. They're trying to get in the containers being pushed by barges and lifting what they can, kind of a maritime smash and grab. And I think that's pretty much what we see off the West Coast, a little different than what we see off of Somalia. Has that transitioned to a taking hostages for ransom situation in West Africa, or is it still smash and grab?
No, I think the taking hostages in Nigeria has been a common event for a long time. I used to work for an oil company that would occasionally have to pay a ransom to get some of its people out. I mean, that's the fine old tradition in that part of the world. And, some of it has now gone to sea. They'll take a crew and you know, ransom them back. The other thing, as we've talked about earlier, was that some of the pirates have been able to grab some of the ships loaded with fuel or gasoline or whatever, and then they will transfer the cargo from the ship they've captured to some other lighters, and they're able to sell that cargo someplace. I found Daniel's note. It says, got a note from a colleague working out of Cabinda, worried about Nigerian military actions against a pirate, worried the violence is about to ratchet up even further. You know, it's entirely possible because you've got a lot of it is based on money and who benefits from the sale of the oil in that area. And, you know, and then some of the pirating has gone to adjacent states to Nigeria. And so, you know, I know that the U.S. Navy and AFRICOM have devoted a lot of time and effort to try and help build up the Coast Guards and of those adjacent nations, in addition to working with Nigeria. But Lee also makes a good point, is that the west coast of Africa is not as close to the major trade routes. Well, the only major trade route actually is the oil business coming out of Nigeria and the other countries in that area. So, you know, that is a major trade route, but it's not the same as the sea lane that goes by Somalia, where it's not just one industry. And then Daniel also points out that, you know, there is this continued debate going on about whether we should put armed guards on ships or not. And I think Claude Barrabee may be an expert on that area. He edited a book about the private military or private security companies and their effect on what should be their effect on piracy and stuff. And the answer is it's had a dramatic effect. I think probably more, in my view, more than the NATO and EU forces off Somalia. And, you know, the question is whether that can be carried out to other parts of the world like Nigeria. And, again, we get into those issues of territorial waters, what the law is in Nigeria, what, you know, whether it should be different for ships that are out at anchor. And let me touch on one other thing you said, which is the, you know, traditional piracy we saw early on in Malacca and some of these other areas, the harbors off the Bangladesh, say, anchorages off Bangladesh, you know, it's the definition of piracy that becomes the issue, because what you have are guys coming on board ships and stealing rope or the crew's wallets or whatever. And, you know, and that continues on. That's not one of those things that's going to go away. That is the nature of the what I call small piracy, as opposed to the big issue piracy of grabbing a whole ship and selling it back.
Yeah, petty theft versus grand theft. As far as things heating up in Nigeria, in that whole, some people call it the elbow of Africa, I call it the armpit of Africa, that's really nothing new. You know, you can go back to 1967, 1970, the Biafra War, 200,000 plus people killed. That's the nature of that part of the world. I think there's some additional interest, you know, with Mali and the Islamists that have seized the top of it. Whatever we get involved in, though, I hope it really doesn't cross the beach any more than what we have done in Uganda. I know we've had some special forces people doing what special forces do, which is help indigenous forces become better. And hopefully that's the extent. But again, it falls back to something we touched on earlier. We were talking about the two major parties. I just don't see there's any appetite by either people in either party or the American public to have more American troops go into some backyard of somebody else to try to fix their problem. And we even saw in Afghanistan, the old, I think his name is Ismail Khan. He is actually part of Karzai's government. He was the Mujahideen commander in the Herat area, and he's having kind of a family reunion with all the Mujahideen commanders. He wants them to get ready for the 2014 withdrawal. I think that's something a lot of us have been talking about, that we're going to see the sectarianism, they're rearming, they're getting ready for after 2014 goes, that they're able to at least look after their people in their particular area. When somebody of his degree comes out in the open to start talking about that, there's other things that's been going on for a while. I just don't see with that taking its natural course over the next few years that we're going to get involved anywhere, whether Nigeria becomes real violent or not. As long as they don't directly impact our ships, I don't think we'll do anything, and I think that's fine.
Yeah, I think it's going to be low-key. I did see on Mali that the French, I saw a rumor mill someplace, was saying the French were gearing up to deal with something in Mali, and that apparently Secretary of State Clinton was also involved in some kind of planning to do something about that. But, you know, like a lot of other things, I got distracted by a squirrel or a shiny object or something. I guess I didn't go back and chase down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, and, you know, the French can have it. That's kind of that's one of their former playpens. They're free to go in there. There was for those that get Defense News, 2 issues ago, there's a real interesting article, kind of some ground facts about what many of us were talking about during the Libyan operation, the whole leap from behind situation. Our allies can do it. I thought one of the great things, the Danes were great and still are allies of ours. You know, population of 5 million and change. They fought caveat free, more or less, in southern Afghanistan, mostly with the British, but alongside some American units as well. During the Libya operation, they boxed way above their weight, but they ran out of bombs. A lot of the European militaries, they are half of a low-key operation away from being Winchester, and the French aren't too far behind them. So I don't know. Maybe the French are smart. They'll do kind of what we were doing in Uganda, go in there with a couple hundred special forces to try to help the indigenous forces to be able to retake their land. But from what I've seen, over half of Mali has already been taken by the Islamists, and they've got the motivation, they've got the backing, and they've got the territory. I don't know if the people in southern Mali have either the manpower, the personnel, or the morale to go up to where the Tuaregs are, and that's tough territory to go up there and fight, but the French can have it.
Yeah, it's of course, the French have a slight advantage, and they can use their foreign legion to do some stuff that if they had to use another kind of force that might cause all kinds of internal dissent. And there are times when I envy them that ability. We have to go cut deals with foreign actors to look out at our interests sometime. I mean, Chris has pointed out on here that we've ceded a chunk of Africa, northern Mali, to Al-Qaeda without much comment by the media. And I think that's an interesting outlook on it, because it is a danger, you know, that we have not and probably will never be able to completely quash Al-Qaeda. But we sure, and I think that was the warning from day one, that killing Osama bin Laden wouldn't really make a whole lot of difference, that it was not the kind of structure where if you killed him, the whole thing would go away.
Well, let me push back a little bit at Chris on this. He said we've ceded northern Mali. Mali's not ours to cede. It's not part of the U.S. It's not even remotely considered an ally. The future belongs to those that show up. And like you said, we've been saying all the way along, this war isn't over. This is going to go on for a long time. We'll kill the next bin Laden. This is a lot bigger than one person. The Al-Qaeda is a franchise. It's much bigger than that. That conversation usually leads people to uncomfortable places, so they choose to ignore it. But if Al-Qaeda or whatever they're calling themselves or whatever version of the franchise takes Mali, they take other parts, it's not ours to cede. What we need to be able to do is to monitor it, and if it reaches the point that we need to throw thousands of American lives and trillions of dollars into pushing it back and do a little bit of aggressive weeding, that's fine. But the root of this plant is going to be there. It's going to grow again. But we didn't seed Mali. the people in southern Mali let al-Qaeda take the north. And I would aggressively argue that it's not our position to try to push them out. Because the minute you push them out, if nobody there is willing to keep them out, they'll be right back in. Americans don't need to die in northern Mali or any place within a 20-hour drive of there, in my opinion.
Yeah, he's got a pretty good rejoinder, which, they are al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda is they're the people who we're going to have to deal with one way or the other. It is one of those burr under the saddle sort of thing. How do you respond? At what point do you get a little more proactive about taking care of this problem? And can you be more proactive? We've got a drone war going on where we've been using unmanned aerial vehicles to blast al-Qaeda leadership. And, what does it say about that effort if we can't seem to, if that's not really stopping the problem?
Well, I would argue that they're not unmolested. It's a cost benefit. Do you play whack-a-mole with them? I would put forward the argument that we're in a situation right now that we probably need to learn how to whack-a-mole pretty good, and instead of having one mallet, have two. Young American men and women standing in the middle of the tar desert, guarding a crossroads from people that don't want to be guarded and protected, there's no way to address al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is now and will be for my lifetime, I place money on it, and probably a little longer than that, it's just somebody that's going to need to be killed whenever you get the opportunity. And, going back to, which party is going to do it, I think both parties are doing it. I think you have different degrees, different flavors of doing it. But it is kind of nice that we have reached a consensus in our country that these are people that just need to be killed. And hopefully we'll keep doing that. And if the variation of al-Qaeda becomes a threat in northern Mali, then we have ways to reach out and smack them with little impact on us as possible. So it's a cost benefit, how much of an effort you're going to do. I think what we won't see back when I was a little kid, and you weren't, in the Libyan desert, there used to be whole terrorist training camps with, Tom Clancy played around with it in one of his novels, but they existed. Well, I don't think either party will let that exist anymore. If there's a host nation that's having, Disneyland for al-Qaeda at this lat long, it's not going to be there for long. So they'll have to do small camps because we have ways to reach out and smack them without actually putting people on the ground.
Yeah, I think Chris makes a pretty good point, though, in that, al-Qaeda does seem to be operating inside our OODA loop. And, from my perspective right now, sitting here knowing absolutely nothing official and only getting my news from unofficial sources, but we do seem to be reactive instead of driving the problem with them. And, I'm not convinced that's the way to go. On the other hand, we every now and then we get proactive, but we do it in a not smart fashion. Daniel was talking about how we got into Somalia. It was not our problem. Well, it became our problem when we began to respond to the news media about starving children in Somalia, and then we expanded the mission set after that. And you got to be smarter than that. You really got to stick to having a plan and a mission that you understand. And, I don't disagree with General Powell's rules about when you go in, you should know what the end state's going to look like. Now, maybe you can't do that with a terrorist war, but it's a good discussion to have.
Yeah, I think history has overtaken the Powell doctrine because I think it's very conventional. It's thinking symmetrical. We're not in a symmetric environment. I think I also don't think it's fair to judge less Aspen. You can judge, but the decision to go into Mogadishu was a different world, with a different planet. We've learned a lot since then on a variety of ways. I think our rules of engagement would be very different nowadays if we went in there again. But you're exactly right. That was a classic respond to media war, that there are places in that part of the world and others that are just as bad now, if not worse. But nobody's doing anything, because I think the powers that be and everybody in between has realized that it's just not worth the effort. Hey, let me just do a head fake here as we're running a little bit towards the hour. One thing I do want to talk about with you, Eagle One, is watching the two parties go back and forth and looking at the geopolitical situation rolled in with what nobody really likes to talk about is the very real budgetary limits there's going to be on the defense budget. Anybody who thinks that we're going to be able to build up 355 or more ships is living in a different fiscal universe than the rest of us. These decisions will get hard. But if, especially if the Romney administration comes in and they try to have a more naval focused, it's an interesting time, because we can almost go back to a neo-originalist standpoint. If you look at the larger threats, why do you need a really, really big standing army? You don't. What you do need is the ability to project power globally in a way that allows you to create effects ashore without getting your feet stuck. That's very much a Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force evolution. You don't get rid of the Army, but it'll be interesting to see if that decision is made to go with the Romney administration or with a second Obama administration. When we look at that defense budget pie, where do those wedges go? We're already seeing the Army continue to decamp from Europe, thank goodness. They had a couple of brigades have stood down. The U.S. Army in Germany is getting smaller and smaller, as of the Army is. But it'll be interesting to see in 4 years how much that wedge of the pie is going to be Navy-wise versus Army-wise, when if you're looking at a larger strategic standpoint, I just don't see the need for a big Army.
Well, it's a great question. I mean, in a couple of weeks, I guess we're going to have Captain Hughes on. He's got this, some of his students got together and wrote this new Navy fighting machine, which discusses a fleet of two different sets, you know, a blue water fleet and a green and brown water fleet of different sizes. And, you know, I think it's a great topic. I'm glad we're getting to discuss it with the man himself. And I wish I had the answer. I don't know how the thinking is on these committees. I do know that former Secretary of the Navy Lehman seems to be a pretty strong participant in the Romney shadow cabinet.
Yeah, he came out of nowhere. Last I really spent any time reading about John Lehman was he was involved in some ferry issues in Hawaii and a few other things. But I found it very interesting that he came out of the woodwork. It's strange, though. And again, maybe it's just me, but a lot of the arguments that Lehman and a few of the other people are making, they're good arguments, they're valid arguments, but they seem to be from a different time and place. I think I posted on it briefly earlier this week, but I will nod my head again at the submarine community. I think they have done a very smart thing. They have taken the replacement ballistic missile submarine program, and they've re-scoped it a bit to be a smaller, more affordable program, which I think is a very defendable and a very smart and a very long a long view position to take. And I think it's a big help for our Navy as well as we recapitalize next decade. That, even with a smaller per-unit price tag, is going to really, really impact our shipbuilding budget if we don't get any purple money for it. You look at the air side of the house and the sea side of the house, I don't see that type of movement, mostly because they don't have much flexibility. The air side of the house is so vested in the F-35 that there's really nothing else moving there. I think we're kind of too big to fail with the 35, and hopefully they'll find a way to make it happen. Eagle One? Going once?
Okay, going I'm twice. Still here. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I got
yeah, I lost you and you lost me. So, yeah, one of my sons was actually talking about that today. We were talking about, you know, what would happen if you loaded up an F-18 and put it against the F-35 with all the crap they've loaded onto it now, you know, and had a dogfight. Who would prevail? You know, it's kind of a question that Boyd would have asked, perhaps, because I don't think he had as much hand in the F-35 as he did in the F-18 type design.
It depends on what variation. If it's 35 Alpha, it gets a nod because it actually has an internal gun, which I still cannot believe the Bravo and the Charlie don't have an internal gun. And don't get the police telling, oh, they have a gun pod. We know how that works. No. Unless you intentionally put it on there. Since the missile age started, they always seem to make that mistake. We don't need a gun. We don't need a gun. Until somebody is peer or near peer next to you and, oh, hey, look, a gun. Or like we saw in Afghanistan, what is that F-15 going to be able to do for me? Well, you know what? It can do a hell of a strafing run and save a lot of people's lives by doing that. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I don't ping on them too much, mostly because I'm holding my breath and hoping that it works out well. On the C side of the house, I think we're the only big question I have is if we do the full run of 55 LCS, or we truncate it to 24 to 30, and how many times we're going to get a lucky roll of the dice where this thing is actually usable. Because there are just no other programs down the road that we can shift things for, unless you just want to keep building Arleigh Burkes to the point that our grandchildren are going to be doing it. Oh, hey, do you want to share the news with the rest of the crowd? Feel free to be a proud father. You're allowed.
Okay, you've lost me now. What am I talking about?
Your son?
Oh, yeah, my younger son, who's a senior in college and an ROTC midshipman, has been selected for flight school. So this will be good.
Well, that way he can buy...
Lifelong dream, by the way.
Well, you know, you got two sons with flight pay. You don't have to buy dinner anymore. That's good stuff.
I just hope they'll take care of me in my really old age.
Well, it's always a plus. The let's see, what else is coming up for the election? Here's one thing that I hate finding myself having to agree with President Obama, but I am pretty close to it. Syria, the benign indifference to Syria, I think has been a really good call on our part. Like I shared with our friend Saturn V here a couple of episodes ago, Syria, to paraphrase a great man, Syria is not worth the bones of one Anatolian grenadier. And it's just not worth it. Some people are talking about we need to intervene more, we need to get more weapons. From what I've read, our weapons are going to, again, Chris's buddies, Al-Qaeda. So what do we do in Syria besides watch from a distance? I think sometimes don't just do something, stand there. Maybe we just need to stand there.
Yeah, and as we wind down here, I think Daniel just made a really good point. Then we changed the topic slightly, but he's reminding us all to go vote. And I don't care who you vote for. It's important. It's really important. We were talking to my sons this afternoon. It's been my father was commissioned in 1939, and so for the last 73 years, it's been somebody serving the U.S. military. And one of the reasons is so you and all the rest of us have the chance to go vote. So please get out there and do your civic duty.
Amen. I can't say anything better than that. That's in theory what we all have done this or are doing this, and other people will do it, is for everybody to have the ability to vote. I'm glad that I early voted. I'm just waiting for everybody else to catch up with me. And I'll repeat my father's line. If you don't vote, sit down and shut up. You got to get out there. You got to vote whoever you're going to vote for. And Eagle One, that's about all I've got here for the last few seconds. Any last minute pimps besides join us for Cat Hughes?
I thank everybody for joining us today and allowing us to pontificate as we occasionally do.
Yep. Thanks a lot, everybody. I appreciate everybody in the chat room. And I hope everybody has a great Navy Day, and we'll see you again for another episode of MidRats.
Friend and pick a billy, or you'll be to blame.